one love to be living for, one love to be living for. This nearly was mine.
Seth MacFarlane is the creative force behind TV's Family Guy, American Dad, and The Cleveland Show. He's also the writer-director of the films Ted, its sequel Ted 2, and A Million Ways to Die in the West. He has released three successful albums of standards, including Music is Better Than Words and No One Ever Tells You. His voice has been celebrated for its perfect phrasing, richness, and consistency. As a result, he's been nominated for 4 Grammys. He has played to sold-out houses at London's Royal Albert Hall, New York's Carnegie Hall, and Symphony Hall in Boston. He'll be back with the Boston Pops this Sunday at 2:30 in the Shed here at Tanglewood. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Seth MacFarlane to the roundtable. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. It's very nice to have you on the program. I have been an admirer of yours for a long time, so it's very nice to have the time to chat.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you very much.
What brought you down this road of wanting to say, okay, this is, I mean, do you consider it, you have a day job and this is something that you do either for fun or another part of your career? How do you define it?
You know, it's something I do purely for the love of it. I mean, my day job is my day job, and that's not changing, but it's interesting because it does kind of creep into my day job at times. We do use a live orchestra on Family Guy and American Dad, and certainly with Family Guy, this kind of music creeps into the series.
Bumba da da bumba da da bumba da da bumba da da bumba
da da bumba. I fell in love with you, heart and soul, the way a fool would do madly, because you held me tight and stole a kiss.
Whether it's jazz or show tunes or orchestral jazz, it's all kind of wrapped up in each other. When I was growing up, I was very, very into orchestras. I was a big fan of film scores. I loved John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith and the composers who were putting out film music at the time that I was a kid. That led me to the orchestral jazz of the 50s, the Nelson Riddle and Gordon Jenkins and Billy May. You know, in the modern era, there's really nothing like that. There's really no one who's writing popular music that really utilizes an orchestra and really shows off a talent for arrangement. I mean, the orchestration itself is unfortunately kind of dying. And I think that's a very, very bad thing for music at large because, you know, that mid to late 50s, early 60s was, you know, as far as pop music is concerned, was really the peak. I mean, it was the highest level of musicality on all levels. And it's, as a result, it's very hard to recreate today. So that's kind of what we try to do. You know, I've spent a lot of time collecting these old charts that are hard to find, and the ones that I can't find, I have reconstructed by a very, very talented fellow in London named Andrew Cotty, who has an extraordinary ear and is able to rebuild the pieces of these things so they're playable. It's really a love for the music and as much a desire to hear the orchestra play the charts as it is a desire to sing them.
You touched a nerve with me in mentioning Billy May and Nelson Riddle, because I just can't think of two better arrangers, and they had such a sound,
yep,
such their own distinct,
yep,
beautiful sound, which even with on your albums with Joel McNeely, you seem to have that, to have a sound.
Yeah. I mean, we're trying to take a cue from that period, in that, you know, at some point in popular music, the music became less important than the words, and it became all about the vocals. It became all about the words, whatever genre you're in. And, you know, the music, you take the vocals out and the music is just sort of a backdrop that doesn't really do anything on its own. Certainly with the Sinatra recordings, you pull his voice out of those tracks and you've still got a pretty extraordinary piece of composition, whether it's Nelson Riddle or Billy May or Gordon Jenkins. And Sinatra himself used to say, look, I'm one part of four things. There's the vocalist, there's the orchestration, there's the lyrics, and there's the melody. That's something that Joel and I have certainly tried to recapture, that this idea that what's going on in the orchestra is at least as important as what's going on with the vocals.
So what has it been like for you to go around the country and the world to play before these great orchestras? You'll be back with the Boston Pops, as I mentioned, on Sunday, and to have you be one of those parts.
Well, I love it. I mean, I'm not a huge traveling fan. I that part of it gets a little tiring, but you know, when you get there and you're in the midst of it, it's all worth it, because you know, you have so many fantastic orchestras throughout the country. I mean, obviously the Boston Pops is one of the best, if not the best, for this kind of music. You really get a sense of each orchestra. I mean, each orchestra really has its own strengths. I mean, we were just in Nashville with the Nashville Symphony, and they had one of the best brass sections that we've heard. So it's you know, each orchestra has its own sort of thing that it does really, really well. And, you know, they all do these kinds of charts beautifully. But you do sort of get to know the kind of ins and outs of each ensemble. And again, I half the reason I do it is to hear these charts played live. Part of me, if I could get away with it, would probably just bring the charts and sit there and listen to them with the audience, because I love the sound of the ensemble, and it's as much a show for me to listen to in that regard as it is for the audience.
I believe you on that, but it seems that just looking at your career and what you've been able to do, that you enjoy using your voice in different ways. You are aware of it, you are aware of what it does, of what it can do, and you like to use it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, some people are born, they can play football, and other people have less profitable talents, which is what I have. I was fortunate enough, thanks to my dad, to be born with an instrument that I can use in various ways, and I was also lucky enough to train with a couple that has since passed away within the past 5 years, Lee and Sally Sweetland, who worked in Los Angeles. And both of them were in their early 90s when I started training with them. And then, she lived to be something like 102, and he passed away when he was about, I think, 98 or so. But I trained with them for 10 years, and they just taught me how to use the instrument and how to manipulate it with no help at all, you know, so you can stand up there with a microphone with no electronic assistance at all and get the sound that you're looking for.
And that is for singing, that is for vocal voice performance, that
for
is
everything.
For, yeah.
It's for everything. And I've subsequently, their son Steve Sweetland took over the business, so now I train with him. It's still to this day. I mean, I was there last week, and it's the method that he and his parents use is, I mean, it's dates back a century, so it's that's been massively helpful. It does help to start with something that has resonance, but you really do have to educate yourself in how to use it. Otherwise, it can, you know, certainly as you get in, you know, as you get older, you can start to have problems if you don't know how to,
right,
you know, even just speak in a, you know, what part of the of your throat or your chest or your diaphragm you're using, it can sneak up on you the older you get. So it is valuable.
You have on the cover of the latest album, you're there, I believe you have a cigarette in your hand. There's a lot of pictures of you in concert with a drink in your hand. Do those help? Or are they just
reason?
Cool?
Yeah. I mean, when I'm recording, I tend not to go near any of that stuff. But you know, I've talked to a lot of vocalists who do concerts and start with a little bit of a little bit of whiskey to loosen up the throat. And it's not, you know, it's not just a throat. It's your, you know, you're performing for an audience, so it just takes a little bit of the edge off your nerves. And it's a, you know, you want to balance it. It does. You have too much, and you lose control of your vibrato. So you have to be very, very disciplined. But once the show's over, you can just get hammered.
I was reading a tweet that you put out a couple of weeks ago that said you're like working through a hangover at today's show.
That was a rare misfire of judgment. I think I had done a show the night before, and had a little too much fun after, paid for it the next day.
But that happens.
But again, like that's where the Sweetlands are invaluable, because all those tricks that they teach you, it's like, all right, I don't have 100% of the instrument, but I still got to make this work in a way so nobody notices. So again, that's where the training helps.
Well, but it also goes back to, that was the Sinatra sound too, right? I mean, that he had the cigarette and the drink in his hand,
there was smoking, there was drinking, there was plenty of that stuff.
I mean,
I'll have a social cigarette once every couple months, you know, so that's something that, you know, will damage your voice early if you do that. So, you know, the alcohol is a little bit more dubious as far as exactly what effect it has.
When in your training and in working, are you working towards something, or are you trying to maintain it? In the sense of, is there still a sound that you are trying to achieve in future recordings?
You know, it's really about exploring what different arrangers and orchestrators can do. You know, Joel, I mean, I work with Joel on everything. He and I just went to London to record some songs with two other orchestrators, with Bruce Broughton, who's a brilliant film composer, and Andrew Cotty, who does all of our takedowns and is also a brilliant arranger composer in his own right. So, and each one has their own sound, I do like to explore what different composers, different arrangers can do, there's not really an end game except to maintain it and keep doing it for as long as my throat holds out.
And as far as other projects, you have a movie coming up in which you get to use the musicality as well.
Yes. Sing, which is directed by Garth Jennings and is about a group of talking animals who put on a talent show in the city. And it's I had a blast. I mean, I play a mouse named Mike, who is sort of a Sinatra-esque character, a lot of attitude and a set of pipes. And yeah, I got to do a couple of fun tunes. And that was enjoyable for me, because it's not often that I work on projects that I'm not helming, and I really liked it. I had fun. It was nice not being the boss.
Seth MacFarlane will be right here at Tanglewood in the Shed performing with the Boston Pops this Sunday at 2:30. 2:30 this Sunday afternoon. Seth MacFarlane. It'll also be broadcast right here on WAMC. You can find out more information about the show by going to tanglewood.org. Tanglewood.org. Seth MacFarlane, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, Seth MacFarlane will be at the Shed here at Tanglewood at 2:30 on Sunday afternoon. Tanglewood.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.